Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight with our guest speaker, Professor Geoffrey Blainey. I'll introduce him briefly. He's well known to all of you. But he's here on the occasion of the recent publication of A Short History of Christianity. Janet Grundy's got some copies down the back, and I'm sure Professor Blainey would be happy to sign any. I'll introduce him briefly. Geoffrey Blainey is one of Australia's most significant and popular historians. He's written some 36 full-length books, including The Tyranny of Distance, Triumph of the Nomads, Black Cattle and Full Moon, A Short History of the 20th Century, Sea of Dangers, and the best-selling A Short History of the World, and now most recently A Short History of Christianity. I think it's fair to say that Geoffrey Blainey is Australia's best recognised and most acclaimed historian, so it's great to have him at the Sydney Institute. And the topic for tonight's talk is Christianity's story. Geoffrey Blainey, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Jared, honoured guests, thank you very much for the generous introduction. It's curious the way books are promoted these days. My first book came out in 1954. It was a book set on the west coast of Tasmania about mining, and I wondered when the book would be published, and the publisher said he didn't know, which was typical in those days. And I remember my excitement walking along Elizabeth Street, Melbourne, and seeing it in the window of a shop. And that was the first I'd heard the book was published. I later learned that it had been published 4 weeks earlier. And now you go and you speak and you sign books and you know exactly when it's going to be published. They tell you not to leave the country in the week it's being published. I'm going to speak for half an hour, which is the practice, and then the meeting is open for questioning. I wrote this book as a historian, not as a theologian or not as a persuader. I had no idea what I would write when I began the book. I began the book out of curiosity, as many people do when they write books. I wanted to know more about it, and being old, I wasn't sure whether I would finish it, and I first wrote about the Reformation, and I thought I was making good headway, and I worked away, and for several years, it's the most difficult book I've ever worked on. When I came to 1800, I thought I'd had enough. And I met at lunch a well-known cricket writer, and he said, "How's your book going?" And I said, "I'm up to 1800, and I think I'll finish it." He said, "You can't do that. You can't finish a cricket match when the score is unknown." And so I worked away, and eventually I finished it. I tried to write a book that would please me, the kind of book that if I were in a bookshop, I'd like to buy. I'm conscious that there's so much talent writing about Christianity still today, but like so many learned fields, people write more and more for each other. They become specialists and they write to please the specialists, and I thought I would try to write a book where I didn't have a glossary and I wouldn't use a term unless I had enough space to explain it. I'm not sure whether I succeeded adequately, but that's what I tried to do. I didn't want the book to be encyclopedic. There are wonderful encyclopedias now on so many subjects. There's an Oxford Dictionary of the Christian Church, about 1,000 or 1,300 pages, the latest edition in 2006, and there are so many things available for those who want to look up something particular. I didn't think I would write about Australia, but occasionally I came across something interesting, and I mentioned that the last time I was in Sydney, Gerald, I went down to Manly. If you're a Victorian, it's a wonderful experience to catch the ferry to Manly. It's one of the great Australian experiences, just as it was in the days of Henry Lawson. You know, when you just cross the heads and the waves come in, if there are waves, and you go ashore at Manly. And I went for a walk to the beach, and then coming back, I passed a church, a congregational church. And I went inside, and to my surprise, it was, of course, a typical congregational church, the foundation stone laid by the Fairfaxes of the Sydney Morning Herald, and the trustee being David Jones of the well-known Emporium, built, I think, in 1862 or 1863. But one of the first pastors, and I'd forgotten this, was a man named Dowie, D-O-W-I-E, a Scot who came to South Australia and had a congregational church at Hamley Bridge, and then was invited to Manly. And from Manly he pressed on, and he became a famous evangelist and moved eventually to Chicago and founded a religious settlement called Zion City that became quite famous. And Zion City caught on in South Africa, and the biggest churches in South Africa today are not the old Dutch Reformed Church, but the various splintered branches of the Zion churches. And my understanding is the biggest Protestant celebration of Easter in the world. It doesn't necessarily have to be large to be the biggest Protestant celebration of Easter, but this is a huge occasion with more than a million people. It's in the Northern Transvaal and presided over by a pastor who was given hands on head by a succession of people running back from Dowie. He's in the book. Could I just begin with a couple of statements that are in the book? Of all the known people of the world, Jesus Christ is the most influential. In 100 years' time, people may change their mind if Islam continues to grow. It's possible that it will reach Christianity in 100 years' time, although these predictions are very uncertain, in which case Muhammad may be a competitor. But I thought about this a lot, and I think it's true at the moment to say that of all the known people of the world, Jesus is the most influential. One other paragraph, and then I'll largely leave the book alone. It's remarkable that a man who lived 2,000 years ago and who held no public office and owned no wealth should have exerted such influence. It's remarkable that a man who at no time travelled more than a few days' walk from his birthplace should have exerted such long-term influence. Even our calendar dates from his birth, though we can't agree when he was born, nor when he died. Those are words from my book, and I still agree with them. After 2 months, some critics say that Christ did not exist. They have their reasons. And it's true that he is hardly mentioned in writings made while he was alive or in the following 10 or 20 years. On the other hand, in my view, his life was well documented by the standard of the times. His life, indeed, is astonishingly documented for someone who lived a simple life in a remote outpost of the huge Roman Empire. In fact, his life, as many of you know, is so surrounded by evidence, most of it compiled in the half century or so after his death, that the problem is one of a glut of evidence. There is so much from so many different sources, and parts of it are inconsistent, and other parts are plain contradictory. I wrote in my book, the Bible is a violin on which scores of tunes can be played. I think that's true. It can play almost too many tunes with diverging moods and meanings. The result is an astonishing mountain of books and articles on the Bible and the Christian religion. In our era, one person could never read them. I haven't done tight calculations, but I would be surprised if you've got all the surviving literature on Christianity written since the 1st century AD, and divided it amongst 50 fast readers, learned scholars, and they each took 1/50th. I doubt whether they would complete in their lifetime all that had been written. As late as 1900 in Europe, more books were published on Christ and Christianity than any other subject. It's no longer true. I'm tempted to suggest that between, say, AD 400 and AD 1900, more intellectual talent was devoted to studying Christianity than to any five other topics added together. It's only a guess, I can't be sure, but the amount of intellectual power that went into that topic is astonishing. Even today, the talent in this field is still large, but its writings generally do not reach a large audience. Theologians and church historians write for each other with plenty of exceptions. But this is increasingly true of most disciplines taught within universities. Even media studies, if you read parts of the Finkelstein report. It's as if the monastic system has been born again in this rather secular era. Should I say a few words about the history of Christianity, or do I assume that everyone here is reasonably well informed?
Don't make any assumptions.
I was told the atheists here far outnumber the others, but often the atheists are well informed on the subjects they debate. Please feel to disagree. Christ was born and lived his life in semi-rural Palestine. Late in his short life, he became an itinerant preacher with 12 Jewish disciples. He preached a distinctive message. In essence, he said, "Love God and love your neighbour. It's better to give than to receive, and it's better to forgive than to seek revenge." It's a pretty impossible religion in some ways. Each of you interested in his life, or some of you a worshipper or a respecter of him, may prefer to express his main message with different emphases. And atheists or agnostics will, of course, see it differently in their own ways. While still young, he was crucified by the Roman authorities in Jerusalem. He was buried, but in the eyes of his closest followers, he rose dramatically from the dead. Eagerly, the followers spread his message, at first in the Jewish synagogues that were scattered along the shores of the Mediterranean and in many parts of Asia Minor. It astonished me when I first read this, but it's believed that in the Roman Empire, about the time of the birth of Christ, maybe 8% of the population was Jewish. It's an astonishingly high percentage, but there is evidence for this. It would be interesting to know whether Christianity would have spread without being part of that remarkable system of synagogues. Of course, the Christian message diverged from mainstream Judaism, and as time passed by, the Christians broke away or were sometimes expelled. From time to time, Roman emperors or local governors persecuted them. I think it's fair to say that the early Christians were asking for trouble, and they did not give loyalty to the Roman Empire or its favoured gods. In the early 300s, by an astonishing turn of events, the new Roman Emperor Constantine tentatively became one of their followers. There's great debate on whether he was a strong follower at the start or very tentative. Certainly his mother was a strong follower. He gave them freedom to worship and soon gave them preference over all other religions. They flourished as never before, becoming the main, but not the only religion in the Roman Empire. In due course, Goths and Huns and others overran the Western Roman Empire, but these invaders were already Christians with their own distinctive theology. The next invaders of the Christian world were Muslims, who came out of Arabia with their cavalry. Between about AD 630 and AD 900, the Muslims conquered Egypt, which was in the great granary of the Mediterranean. They conquered Libya and all coastal North Africa. They captured Spain and part of France and much of Western Asia and Central Asia, and even Jerusalem. Most of this vast territory was never recovered by Christianity. Muslim pirates even raided Rome in about the 840s and pillaged sacred sites. It's interesting, it's very hard to know what public opinion is on historical events at any time, but my belief reading English and American and Australian letters to the editor intermittently is that certainly since September 2001, the belief has been widespread that the hostility between Muslims and Christians really began with the Crusades, and it's as though a vast area of human history has been wiped from common consciousness. How that happens, one doesn't know. In the course of the Muslim conquests, Christianity declined. It was now second only to Islam in numbers and influence. If you lived in the year 1000 and you were well informed, and you were asked which religion, if religion survived, would become dominant in the year 2000, I think you would say, without hesitation, Islam. By 1500, Christianity was rising again. Christian nations, especially Spain and Portugal, had just discovered the Americas and the new sea route around Asia. Christians became the chief missionaries in these lands. Today, six of the seven main Christian nations of the world lie in these territories opened up and occupied by Europeans. Six of the seven main Christian nations in the world today lie in what loosely was called the New World. It's only in recent centuries that Christianity became the world's main religion. At least that's my calculation. So trade follows the flag, and so does religion. And when Christianity came to Australia, it came from the British Isles. The first pastor in Sydney was Richard Johnson, of evangelical background, and there's rather a moving plaque in that little triangle only 150 yards from here. What do you call that little, where Richard Johnson is? It's just a tiny little triangle.
Johnson Square.
It's
across the road from Chipley Town.
You can see I'd never win a trivia quiz. Johnson Square, that's self-evident. Christianity, of course, has had a profound influence on Australia, and maybe we could have discussed this if anybody was interested in question time. But the thought struck me the other day, and oddly it's never struck me before. Quite clearly the Australian flag is a Christian flag because it has the crosses of St. Patrick and St. Andrew and St. George. But of course we forget that the Southern Cross is a Christian cross. The Southern Cross is not there as an abstract commentary on geography. It's there as a Christian cross. I don't know whether the major supporters of the Eureka Stockade would think of that, but the Eureka flag is essentially a Christian flag, and to me it's modelled much more on an Irish cross than it is on that glorious constellation which we occasionally see from the city when the lights are not too bright. Just one little thing about Australia. Have you ever seen the 1933 census? It was the only census, I stand corrected, there may be a modern census, it was the only census for a long time where people were asked questions about religion and other things which enabled the census taker to bring them together. And I think at that time, 80% of Australians who married somebody of the same religious denomination. Not just that Catholic married Catholic, but the Congregationalist married Congregationalist and Presbyterian married Presbyterian. Just a little aside, when you write books, you learn a lot from the letters or emails or spoken thoughts you receive. I've received quite a big number. I've got far more than I expected. And you learn from these. Some letters are well-argued criticisms of my emphasis or interpretation. I may or may not accept them, but I take them seriously. One, for example, is a gracious letter, one of the most gracious letters I've ever received, written on an old manual typewriter. The writer liked the book, a priest, and then added, "In contrast to your near silence in regard to St. Peter, almost your entire chapter 3 is dedicated to St. Paul." "St. Paul was a magnificent apostle, and I love him dearly, but..." And I understand his point of view. Another reader noted quite fairly that I hardly mentioned that great provoker of apocalyptic movements, the Book of Revelations, and it's true, I hardly mention it. A religious scholar of international fame has written to me in a confidential letter. I wouldn't dare even hint at his name. He says, "John Paul II, despite the charisma with which you invest him, has wrecked the Catholic Church." The most heartening comments are from people who say that suddenly they see the jigsaw as a whole. Whether they see it in the right perspective is not for me to say, but they say for the first time they see it. Just a few comments on the world we live in. A charming email came in November, soon after the book was published, from a reader who says he has read the book in one weekend. I'm not sure what to think of that. Or what his wife thought of it. He said he had not intended to devour it so quickly. I quote, "The Qantas troubles forced me to go from Sydney to South Africa via Dubai." And here is a note about the changing world of the church from a former nun now married. She says, "Have ordered a copy of your book for the two Indian priests in our parish." A reader sent me, finally, 6 postage stamps and a printed prayer from St. Francis of Assisi. I take it as a gesture of goodwill, but I don't know what the postage stamps are for. The history of Christianity and of atheism and agnosticism, it's a vital part of our civilization. It's a vital part, too, of the history of Australia. But we don't know enough about it, and it's not easily taught. Could I just finish with these thoughts? Why is Christianity in decline in the more prosperous and educated of the modern nations? Most of us, I think, envisage the history of Christianity as like a wide, fast-flowing river that, within a few centuries of the life of Christ, became very powerful and dominant in most of the areas where it existed. But it's now narrowing and slowing for the first time, the narrowing and the slowing taking place, especially in the prosperous Western nations. I think these are the following are fair comments. First, the decline is very uneven. It is far less in Poland than in Holland. And while Holland has been withdrawing missionaries from the world in the process of decolonisation, Poland was sending them to Africa in very, very large numbers. The decline of Christianity is far less in the United States than in England and Scotland. The decline, in fact, is incredibly uneven. I have not heard this said before, but this is my view. I could be wrong. Christianity is less in decline in USA, less in decline in USA, where I was more influential in USA today, than it was influential in France 250 years ago. In other words, Christianity is stronger in the USA than it was in France 250 years ago, when France was, by most definitions, the number one nation and the most populous in Europe, which makes you think about the unevenness of this phenomenon that we often hear discussed. May I make a tentative observation on Australia? Christianity is obviously stronger in Australia than it was in 1812. I suspect Christianity is still stronger in Australia. More about Jesus is known by the average citizen today than even in 1850. There was a vast Christianisation of Australia. It took place in the gold rushes with the free migrants coming in such large numbers. And my impression, and it's very hard to prove, is that by 1900, church-going, which is one of the few ways we can attend Christian belief, church-going was more common in Australia than in England, when England was still one of the great Christian nations of the world. Could I add something that has taken me by surprise? My own studies, imperfect as they are, suggest that in many periods, Christianity really only had hold of a small but influential section of the population. Every now and then when you read the original writings, you come across statements that take you by surprise. Many people in the 16th century said that Geneva was the most godly place known. Calvin, John Calvin was in charge, and the Calvinists occupied that previously Catholic city. But I have come across a sermon given by John Calvin. He used to give two or three sermons written out, very thoughtful each week. And Calvin says that, in his opinion, most of the people in Geneva are not really Christians. They believe luck or astrology or a much more influential, chance, good fortune, are much more influential than Christ or God. And that's a very interesting statement, isn't it? If you read the evidence taken by the Factory Commission, which in the 1840s in England was investigating the working and social conditions in the new textile towns and coal mines that were changing the world from the base of north and central England, you know, they find a surprising proportion of children do not know the name of Jesus. In fact, there's a well-known Australian historian who, when he was young, K.S. Inglis, wrote a book on English church going in the 19th century, and the question was, when did the working class, the phrase he used, which then, I suppose, occupied about 60% of the households in England, or 70%, when did they stop going to church? And the answer was, they never went to church. I suppose the same may well be true of atheism in the last 50 years, even in Australia. Their percentage of the population has vigorously increased, so the census says. And many atheists are articulate and thoughtful and on the attack. But I think most atheists are not in the least interested. They have left Christianity, if they ever belonged to it, and now they belong nowhere. I'm not saying that about the articulate, thoughtful ones for whom it's a kind of almost a crusade. Finally, has religion declined in the modern world in the last 100 or 200 years? I'm not sure if it has in the countries with a high standard of living, Europe, North America, Australia and so forth. I'm not sure if it has declined. I'm inclined to think that religion has not declined. What has happened is that alternative religions have taken the place of Christianity. The alternative religions include communism, which had a wonderful spin in the 20th century and now is in extreme decline. In some form or other, I think it will come back. It won't have that name, but collectivist movements are too much part of human attitudes to die away completely, and some form of communism, I think, will come back. But communism was very much a system of faith with many characteristics to other religions. And nature is an alternative religion. There are two kinds of greens. There are the light greens who believe that there are important parts of the environment that must be preserved, but the jobs must be created and life must go on. And there are the dark greens who believe that the world is in a permanent state of ecological crisis. The dark greens have nearly all the seats held by greens in the parliament, and the dark greens, I think, see nature as an alternative, as their religion. And finally, the third religion is science and its cousin technology and its God, which I suppose you'd say reason. Science has become incredibly powerful and influential and understandable. So much of our increased standard of living in the last 150 years has come from science and technology, and understandably science is worshipped by large numbers of people, even if they might indicate it. I myself have written widely about the influence of technology, and some people say I place more emphasis on technology than any other historian in Australia, and maybe that's right. So I'm friendly to technology and science, but I think science has reached the stage where in a lot of areas it's given the benefit of the doubt which is given to all the dominant religions in their heyday. I really have not thought of this before, and I don't make this as an anti-science point. I marvel at the way when something which everybody believed in and science said is true and was taught in schools and was the truth, when a new discovery is made, we only hear the new discovery. There's no apology. There's no apology for the fact that science was so wrong and so misleading to the previous generation. I think it's, as a powerful discipline, remarkably lacking in humility. And any discipline, any God that's lacking in humility is ultimately heading for a fall.
Thanks. Just stay there. Many thanks to Professor Blaney. There, Janet Grundy's got some copies of a short history of Christianity down the back, which is Penguin, and not long out. So firstly, thanks to Mellicent for the use of this facility today. Now we come to questions and discussion. We'll finish no later than 7 p.m. As you know, this is a book not of advocacy, it's a book of history. But your comments earlier about the Crusades were provocative, because what, as I understand, what you're saying in your book is that in a sense, whilst the Crusades have been interpreted as a kind of form of aggression by the Christian Church, in fact it was much more a defence of what mechanism, what would now be called a kind of pushback. So how would you sum, I mean, I know you covered it briefly in your talk, but how do you now see the Crusades? And there's some element of this is kind, your position reflects a change in interpretation over the last 10 or 20 years about the Crusades.
Yeah. I think that faiths which are strongly believed in are likely to be intolerant. People who strongly believe in a faith or a faith system, believe in it ardently, are likely to be intolerant. I think in human history, intolerance is the normal course of events, and we're in a new era where maybe for the last 150 years... substantial bodies of opinion see great virtues in toleration. Whether this will last, I don't know, but I look back on Islam's conquest of so much of Christian Europe from the time of Muhammad onwards, and the relatively failed attempts of Christianity to take back what they've lost is something that is almost typical of human history. It will happen equally with kings who are powerful and want to take back territory. So I don't feel a strong need to moralise about that event. That's what human history has been like for much of its course, and therefore I think it's noble, and I suppose it's Christian if a powerful leader apologises to Islam for the Crusades. I'm not sure whether it, apart from a gesture of goodwill, it is really very sensible, because if that leader had lived in that time, there's no doubt whatsoever that if he was going to be a leader, he would have supported the Crusades.
Professor, if you were in a position of influence in terms of education systems, how would you want Christianity to be taught, if at all? Is it something about cultural literacy of a society that you think is perhaps not captured in a way that it could be?
I think the history in Australia at some stage of the syllabus, the history of Judaism and Christianity and Islam should all be taught. I think Christianity is especially important because so much of our languages, especially the articulate use of language, is influenced by the Bibles, Tyndale's Bible and the King James Bible in the early period of the Reformation, and a large proportion of the metaphors that are used by the good writers of the 19th century are biblical metaphors. And you hear people saying now they're teaching a class, even in English, in year 12, that you have to explain the metaphor, because a whole generation has risen without part of the metaphor. I myself would have a more powerful reason for teaching religion. Religion tries to grapple with the difficult problem, what is human nature like? Any statement about God is also a statement about mankind, and I myself think, looking back, and you may disagree, that the great tragedy of the Western world in the last two centuries is to have periods of optimism where it believes that religion has nothing to offer, that man can solve all problems. And I look on Germany, a country which in many ways it's unfashionable to admire Germany, and if I were a Jew I certainly wouldn't admire it, but looking in the sweep of history I admire Germany but feel terribly sorry for it. There in many ways was the great shining light of Western civilization in 1900, with a very strong belief in reason, even the Lutheran Church powerfully affected by the perfectibility of man. And there's a nation that produced, you know, one of the greatest villains of which we have record in history, and elected to power. And I really think that education has to grapple with the problem somewhere or other of human nature, and imbue students with the idea that this is as important as any scientific problem, whether you believe that human nature is perfectible or whether you believe that people will always have a tendency to bad and a tendency to good. I'm not speaking as an expert, I'm just speaking from my observations of history, and that to me would be the most powerful reason why you should teach the history of religions, learning both the bad things about them and the important message that has come down from the Old Testament. I sometimes say to myself, I once read a whole lot of thank you speeches by Nobel Prize winning scientists, great speeches, and I thought to myself, well, there's really more wisdom in the best parts of the Old Testament than there are in the best Nobel Prize winning speeches. And I don't in any way criticise those great men and women.
Very much, Professor, for your broad sweep of history. I wondered if you'd like to comment on the important role played by the Clapham sect. You mentioned Richard Johnson, and as you know, Clapham sect were involved in the links through to Wilberforce, and then the role of Christianity in the churches in establishing schools and social services in Australia that weren't provided by government until very much later.
I think the Clapham sect, a group of South England evangelicals, mostly around Clapham Junction, Clapham Common. They had profound influence. I think their most influence was, most beneficial influence was on the abolition of the slave trade and then the abolition of slave ownership. I think that was a remarkable thing for Britain to do at that time. Britain, the commercial leader of the world, and gaining very much from slavery and throwing aside that disadvantage, ultimately to be conquered by other Christian nations, much more than by Islam. We forget that we think now that slavery was a wasteful system. Slavery, of course, was a very efficient system economically. Terrible for the slave, but very good for the owner of slaves. And we forget that Cuba's sugar economy, dominated by slavery, gave a much higher standard of living to the Europeans in Cuba than was gained by people living in what is now the United States. Slavery was brutal, a very efficient way of reducing sugar and coffee and cotton in tropical climates, and that was surrendered by the most powerful trading nation in the world. So I think that's one of the great achievements. There have been many failures of Christianity, but I think the abolition of slavery was, and of course it's still going, slavery is still a powerful institution, but it was one of the great achievements of a relatively small Christian group.
That question up here over here.
So you mentioned that the French were extremely powerful and cultured and an outstanding nation, and then the religion had sort of disappeared there a bit. But of course, the main problem for the French has been argued, I think that might be right, is that the Huguenots, their treatment of the Huguenots was a watermark, really, as far as the development of various nations around the world. Once they had treated them so frightfully and banished them all, or murdered them or whatever, it's often even argued that the French Revolution was hastened by the fact that there wasn't a good, strong, evangelical or whatever, middle class to fight with the powers that be.
Yeah. The question was about the French Revolution. You're arguing that maybe the French Revolution wouldn't have occurred if the church there had been more influential, and if the Huguenots had a leavening influence for a period of time. I mean, it's a proposition. I don't know how to answer it. It's a proposition. The Huguenots, of course, as so many Protestants were then, tended to be from the trading and the merchant groups, and I think France lost economically through their move to England, and especially Prussia. And Prussia took big numbers of the Huguenots. I think the Prussian royal family were Calvinists, weren't they, at that stage? That may or or may not be so. Maybe what should have happened in France is that there should have been a Catholic revival. My own view is that any faith system only lasts in a strong form for a few generations and has to be reborn. And whereas England had the Whitfield and Wesley revivals, and France didn't have anything like that in the second half of the 18th century. But it's a difficult topic, and I don't pretend I can answer your question.
Down the back, Andrew Robinson, down the back, yeah, and then up here.
Professor, I wonder if you could give us your views. There appears to be a revival and indeed a great increase in Christianity in South Korea and to a degree in China itself. Can you give us your thoughts on this, what it might foretell, and the reasons for these perceived developments?
South Korea has had a strong Christian strand at least since the Japanese occupation at the start of the 19th century, and I think Christianity became a bit like Poland, the movement of the nationalism. South Korea is one of the two or three strong Christian countries in Asia, and there are very few of them. China is a more interesting one. There's no doubt about it that the communists in China, after encouraging Christianity and saying you're part of us, they eventually turned on Christianity, and it was virtually abandoned by the time of the Cultural Revolution. It was almost impossible to be a Christian in China. I used to go to China for the government, for the Australia China Council, every year in the late 70s and the early 80s, and we had an excellent CEO, Dr. Jocelyn Chay of Sydney, who knew China so well, and if there was a free Sunday morning and we didn't have any engagements and negotiations, I would say to her, could you find a church? And she would find a church, like a good civil servant, and it was astonishing to see these buildings in European 1870s to 1920 architecture, perhaps with seats for 800 people, full again, but of course old people and a few little children taken along. You would ruin your prospects in life if you were a teacher or a deputy factory manager if you were found going to Christian church. And I mean, as they're still under threat of persecution to some degree, but my understanding is that while many Chinese Christians meet in the old Catholic and Protestant churches, the biggest number of Christians in China now meet in houses. I mean, that's widely said. I don't suppose people have statistics, and those who are interested in the statistics in China say that there are about at least 50 million Chinese Christians, which of course only gives you, 3% or something like that of the Chinese population. Others say there could be, 100 million, but it's curious, isn't it, that Christianity seems to have had such a revival in China. The same thing, of course, has happened in Russia under different circumstances once the communist regime collapsed, because the old Tsarist Orthodox Church was very much part of the old Russian nationalism, and it's been revived. It will be interesting to see what happens in China, whether Christianity becomes extremely powerful or not, but I'm unable to predict.
Ben,
you mentioned just briefly that I guess the age of Jesus, I think you could say that he was 33 when he was crucified. Can you, talk a bit about that relative youth, and I guess from a historical point of view, just how rare it is for someone so young to have such a big impact on the world, and do you see any links to the radicalism that he was preaching, and maybe talk to a bit whether that radicalism has been maintained in the church or maybe lost at the time?
Yeah, people here may have different ideas. I think most theologians and biblical scholars would argue that that Jesus was a radical, not simply a radical, but that there was both a strong traditional Judaic strand in him and also a radical strand. His attitude to women, for example, his attitude to poverty. The lot of the Catholic revivals of the late 20th century in South America have put emphasis on Jesus as a radical against poverty, and he was killed because he was a radical. If he had been Orthodox, he would have lived on with much less influence, of course. But religions keep on changing, and they reinterpret their heroes, and I suppose you'd have to say that that's perhaps the strength of Christianity, that has given rise to such diversity, both conservative and radical, and has gained enormously from that. my own belief, and if I was Pope or the Archbishop of Canterbury, I wouldn't have a bar of this belief. I think that a religion gains through diversity. A religion is strongest when it's splintering and there are breaks away. But of course it's very difficult, if you're controlling a religion, to handle this. I think one of the great gifts of the Catholic Church was to allow the breakaways to form separate orders within the church, and they were still Catholics, but you look at the Franciscans, it's incredible, isn't it, that the Franciscans were allowed to remain in the fold when they were so radical by the economics of the 1210-1220 AD. So my view is that Christianity gains through diversity, and these organisations which rejoice when they unite are really putting up a brave front. I think the Uniting Church, with all respect, hasn't been a great success, even though they were entitled to rejoice on the day they united.
My question's actually already been answered, but I'd like to hear more about the capacity of the church to adapt and to modernise today. I mean, in the past, maybe it was able to, but it seems to me that the Vatican is such a political, bureaucratic structure that it's difficult for it to modernise and adapt.
I should ask a member of the audience I see here with such great knowledge of the Vatican that I dare not... It's a difficult question, isn't it? I think you would say in 1900 that the churches that were adapting the most rapidly seemed to have the future in their hands. And when the liberal theology came in and was so powerful in Germany and the United States, the belief that the great life was here on earth, that man was perfectible and we could make the perfect society on earth, and that human beings were innately good if you only gave them the correct environment, that seemed to be the future. And meanwhile, the Catholic Church and the, what do you call them, the fundamentalists, the Assemblies of God who were just being formed, people said they're so conservative, they've got no future. But by 1950, it was fairly clear that the Catholics had the future rather than these mainstream sects which had decided that human beings were perfectible and that God might be a help occasionally, but we don't need his money to build our church. And so the Catholics, I think, won that round, but whether the Catholics should have done otherwise at the time of the Second Vatican, I don't know. People applauded them for their modernising, didn't they? Or large numbers of them did, but now, that quotation I read out, large numbers of Catholics think that they have to enter a new burst of modernisation. Women is really, to me, the most interesting issue. Would be impertinent of me to comment on what any church should do, but the fact is unmistakable that women were profoundly influential in the early history of Christianity. Women more than men were at the crucifixion, more than the loyal disciples were there at the resurrection. The early Christian church in the first 300 years, women were often very powerful, as the epistles of St. Paul say, but then the church became male-dominated, and less so in the Orthodox Church in Eastern Europe and in Asia Minor, and that's the big issue. But how you handle it, it may be, if it is handled, it will lead to breakaways and diversity, and the diversity will be the salvation in that huge world-embracing church. But I'm not a Catholic, and it's not for me to say what they should do.
I'm getting very close to the end. I think there's a question here.
I just wanted to say that you mentioned earlier that you got a letter from someone saying that John Paul wrecked the Catholic Church. But I just wanted to put it out there that I don't think it's known that he also believed that the religions of the world like Islam and Judaism and Christianity can coexist.
They can coexist.
They can coexist. So that's a new modification. Mm.
Yes.
New idea.
I believe they can coexist.
And he believed that as well.
Yes, I believe they can coexist. It will often be difficult.
Very close to the end, John.
I think this is. If I just make this minor point, Jared, my belief is that democracy owes more to Christianity than to any other single force. The belief expressed by Paul that in Christ Jesus we're all, was it free, male and females, slave and free, and so forth. That's a profoundly democratic statement, isn't it? If you take it seriously, not that it was taken all that seriously in long periods, but and once the Reformation took place, the Catholics, of course, led the Protestant Reformation. Catholic priests led the Protestant Reformation, but when they eventually broke away, they had to appeal to a new authority, and the new authority, the only one they could appeal to was the congregation. And by appealing to the congregation, you're making a profoundly democratic statement by the standards of the time. So I'm inclined to see Christianity as one of the great creators of democracy, and Islam has not lent itself so far to democracy outside Turkey and a few other places.
Very brief question, John.
Yes, Professor. I noted that you said that it was quite difficult to complete this book, and I was leading through the Great Seesaw this afternoon and noticed that you said that it took you 9 years to complete that book. Could you give us some insight into your historical method in how you prepare and complete such a huge task?
Well, I think that's a good question to end on, so make that the concluding question.
Yeah. I read a book, and I read a book that came out in 1988. I called it The Great Seesaw. It was something or other in the Western world since 1750. I put an enormous amount of time into it. The book was another failure. I still support it, but nobody took any notice of it. What I argued was that there are most powerful fashions in ideas, extremely powerful fashions in ideas. And while we all say, well, we're intellectuals and we're weighing things carefully and so forth, just as the motor car and the tie, the width of the tie we're wearing and the clothes the women are wearing are interested by fashion, ideas are most powerfully influenced by fashions. And that was the argument. I said there's a seesaw, and when science and technology are in favour, nature is out of favour, and the reverse. I still believe it's true. I'm not talking about everybody, but the seesaw affects people who are influential in dictating how all the others think. The book having been such a failure and nobody taking any notice of it, you can't really ask me why I'm so successful.
Then why did you write this book?
Why did I write
that? Which I expect will be successful.
Yeah, I read this book out of curiosity. I thought I could see the book, I could see times when I became interested in various places. And but after September the 11th, I think that spurred me on. Not fully, but I thought, here we are defending a civilization that seemed to be under partner attack, and not really sure how that civilization came into being and what were the parts that needed defending. And when you read the letters to the editor in, let's say, the years 2001 to 2005, the number of letters which said religion is responsible for all our faults, labelling Islam and Christianity together, I thought, well, that can't be true. Religion does great things as well as bad things. And I think that more than anything made me think, I'm not sure how I would defend our civilization. I'm not sure how I would defend our religion. I didn't even know enough about the Christian religion in the wider sense, because my background was very much Protestant, evangelical Protestant, and we knew nothing about Catholics when I was a child. Curiously, in the towns I lived in, the great rivalry was between the Protestant sects. They knew there was no hope whatsoever of converting Catholics. So their great rivals were those who could be poached. like champion rugby league or Aussie rules players. And it's quite a complicated question, isn't it, the question of religious rivalries? And it was my ignorance of that that made me work and work away. And now I'm much better informed than I was, but of course, my deficiencies.
Many thanks.
Good. Thanks very much.
Very brief. Janet Graney's got some copies of A Short History of Christianity. Look, it's been a truly remarkable career with more to go. I don't think 6 decades ago when you left Melbourne University and you were down on the very isolated west coast of Tasmania writing about the mines there that anyone would have thought you'd end up writing about the world and then writing about Christianity. So it's been a great achievement. We're delighted you're here tonight. It's an important speech. Be published in the Sydney papers, up on our podcast. ABC Big Ideas is here and they're welcome to. So for tonight, well done. We'll have you back again in the not too distant future. Thank you, Geoffrey.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.